This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. In an article titled Trump's Deep State Hit List, my guest Jonathan Swan writes about how the Trump White House and its conservative allies over the past 18 months assembled detailed lists of government officials who should be ousted because they weren't loyal to Trump, and lists of Trump loyalists to replace them. Swan says he was briefed on or reviewed these memos and lists. Most of the details he revealed had not been previously published. Swan writes that the president's distrust has intensified since his impeachment and acquittal. These lists help explain some of the recent personnel changes in the Trump administration. Swan is national political reporter at the news website Axios and writes the weekly Axios Sneak Peek newsletter. He covers the Trump presidency and Republicans in Congress. He's broken some big stories, including that Trump was going to pull out of the Paris climate deal, recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital, and end DACA. Jonathan Swan, welcome to Fresh Air. So I want to ask you about your article this week headlined Trump's Deep State Hit List. What qualifies this as a hit list?
So President Trump, I mean, we all see the public desire for him to root out his enemies. You know, he's tweeted, you know, we need to get the bad people out of government, etc. What we uncovered in our reporting was that there's actually quite a long paper trail behind this, that over the last 18 months, the president has been asking for names of people within his government who are disloyal, who are quote-unquote never Trump or anti-Trump or quote-unquote the bad people. He's told aides that he feels that there are snakes everywhere, quote-unquote. And so what
by we... By everywhere, he means like in the Justice Department, Department of Homeland Security, the Defense Department.
All of those, and also in the White House. So he has a network outside the White House, which is comprised of very well-connected conservative activists. One of them in particular is Ginny Thomas, who is the wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. Others include Republican congressional staffers, the head of Judicial Watch, which is a conservative legal watchdog group, Tom Fitton. And they have a weekly meeting on Wednesdays where they get together to plan how to attack the left and also how to root out the quote-unquote deep state within Donald Trump's government. They've been providing memos and lists to the president for the past 18 months. And I reviewed or was briefed on several of those memos that have shaped his thinking in recent times.
So there literally are lists. Like when you write hit lists, there's literally lists.
Yes, that's right. There are lists of names. And I've seen both people he should fire and the reasons that he should fire them, and then also lists of people he should hire who, because they are loyal to the president, pro-Trump, and you know, we also published the names of those people, including Dan Bongino, who's a Fox regular, former Secret Service agent. You know, they put him up for a senior counterterrorism role. So it's both fire lists and hire lists. And the reason this matters right now is the president's been hearing this for a year and a half now, but since impeachment and since acquittal, aides have told me he's crossed a psychological line in the sense that he feels an urgency to get rid of these people. He saw a number of State Department officials testify in the impeachment hearings, and he felt this intense anger that here were these people that were supposed to work for him, that were betraying him, disloyal to him, bad people. And so what he did was quite extraordinary. He fired the head of Presidential Personnel Office. This office doesn't get a lot of attention in the mainstream media. Most people have never heard of it, but it's a very important office. It's an office that is in charge of picking personnel, political appointees across the government. He put in that job his 29-year-old body man, Johnny McEntee, who had worked on the Trump campaign. He was a college quarterback, a football player, worked on the Trump campaign, came into the White House as Trump's body man, so literally traveling around with him sort of as his personal aide. And then he was fired by the former chief of staff, John Kelly, for some security clearance-related issues. President Trump has brought him back into the White House and put him in charge of this office. And It's really for one reason. He sees Johnny McEntee as a pure loyalist, and he has given him the brief that he needs to get rid of the bad people.
Wait, so let's back up a second. Yeah. So he was fired by General John Kelly.
Correct.
When Kelly was chief of staff at the White House.
That's right.
For security issues. What were those issues?
I've been very careful not to say them because I haven't been able to confirm exactly what it was. It was handled in a very strange way, and he was sort of, even people who were there at the time think that it was actually handled quite badly. He was sort of hauled out of the White House, and there were some reports that it may have had something to do with gambling. But again, we've been very careful because we haven't been able to confirm exactly what it was. But Trump brought him back in, and he had this very interesting meeting last week where he summoned the White House liaisons at each of the cabinet agencies to the White House. This is on Thursday. And it was an introductory meeting. It was all very pleasant. But he asked them, he said he wanted to know who were the anti-Trump people at the agencies.
So, this is McEntee, the new personnel head. Okay.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And so just so you understand, he's not talking about people who are career government employees who have, you know, worked in the government maybe for 20 years. These are political appointees that President Trump himself appointed or that his cabinet secretaries appointed. So the extent of the distrust is so deep that President Trump is asking his head of personnel to root out the bad people among his own political appointees.
So Johnny McEntee, the new head of the Presidential Personnel Office, he's 29. He has no personnel experience.
Correct.
And he has hired as his new assistant the Presidential Personnel Office's Director of Operation, a 23-year-old senior at George Washington University.
Yes, Politico just reported that story. And he's replacing a woman who has had experience for decades in personnel. So it's quite striking.
So is this a pattern that you're seeing, that Trump has his hit list of who to remove and the people he's replacing them with are loyalists, but they don't necessarily have any experience or credentials for the job they were being appointed to?
I couldn't say that that's happening everywhere, but it is a pattern. And experience matters far, far less to Trump than loyalty. It's not even close.
So you said that you actually saw some of the lists and some of the memo was being given to President Trump of who to fire and who to hire. Give us a sense of what you've read in the hit list of who to get rid of.
So there's this extraordinary memo. This memo was given to President Trump early last year, I'm told. And President Trump passes the memo on to his then head of the Presidential Personnel Office, Sean Ducey. And Ducey apparently reads this memo, and it's largely an attack on him. So just to like underscore that, the president has funneled this memo to his head of personnel, and the memo is basically saying, this guy Ducey is an obstructionist, he's undermining you, all of this stuff. It lays out a number of people at the State Department who need to be fired, including the deputy Sullivan and various others, David Hale, who ended up testifying in the impeachment hearing. And then at the end, it makes this extraordinary allegation that Sean Ducey had doctored a document, had sneakily changed the name of an appointment, knowing that the president wouldn't possibly see it as a way of sneakily getting someone else in instead, you know, an establishment anti-Trump person instead of a loyalist. And I'm told by people who were there at the time that that accusation was just false on its face because of the timeline in which this happened. It just couldn't possibly have been true. But that gives you a sense of what these documents say. It's basically bolstering Trump's instinctive suspicions that he's surrounded by people who are against him, undermining him, don't have his best interests at heart. And that has only been exacerbated by the impeachment hearings.
So when Sean Ducey gets this memo from Trump with a list of names of people to fire because they're not loyal enough to Trump, and Ducey finds that his own name is on page one of this memo, what happens to Ducey afterwards?
Well, he stays in the job for another year. And my understanding is that there was a conversation with the president, that he and a colleague had a conversation with the president about this. I mean, there was false information in this memo. The last part, according to people who were there at the time, was just a false smear against him. So my understanding is that they explained that to the president, and he stayed in the job for another year before he was replaced by Johnny McEntee.
So let's talk a little bit about Jessie Liu. Now, she had been the D.C. U.S. attorney, which is a very powerful role. And she was leaving that position with the plans of taking a top Treasury job. And then she was told, you're not going to get the Treasury job. So now she's out of a job. What are the reasons why she is not going to get the position that she was told she was going to get?
So Jessie Liu is a really instructive case. She is a political appointee, again, not some career government person. President Trump's Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin was the one who wanted her in this senior role at the Treasury Department. President Trump had agreed to that. He had, in fact, nominated her publicly. She had been taken off her role as the U.S. attorney for D.C. and was all prepared for her confirmation hearing, which was happening later that week. And then President Trump suddenly withdraws her nomination. And of course, there's a whole lot of speculation about why that happened. A lot of people believed that it was because, as the U.S. attorney, she had overseen the prosecution of President Trump's longtime political advisor, Roger Stone, and that that was Trump's vengeance for that. Turns out it's a lot more than that. Again, another memo. So I've been briefed on this memo that was given to the president that apparently had quite an effect on him and that he reviewed before he withdrew this nomination. It was a memo written by Barbara Ledeen, who is a Republican Senate staffer, and she's part of this groundswell network that Ginni Thomas belongs to, the Wednesday meetings again. Anyway, this memo has 14 sections to it, each outlining another sin that they believe Jessie Liu committed in her job as U.S. attorney. It's quite an illuminating document because it includes things like the fact that she signed the sentencing memo for General Michael Flynn, President Trump's former national security advisor. It includes
I stop you there? And he's a friend of Barbara Ledeen's, right?
Yes, he is a friend of Barbara Ledeen's.
Who's making up this list.
Who wrote the memo,
yeah,
correct.
Yeah, who wrote the memo.
So it also includes the fact that Jessie Liu, in her job as U.S. attorney, did not indict Andrew McCabe, the former deputy FBI director, an enemy of President Trump's. It includes all sorts of things. You know, there was another allegation that she had, quote unquote, covered up James Comey's emails from being released. Anyway, it's a long, long list.
Can I add one more that you mentioned in your article?
Yeah.
That she didn't act on criminal referrals of some of Justice Kavanaugh's accusers.
That's correct. That was another item listed in the list. It was a very long list.
So we've been talking about the hit list, basically, that President Trump has to get rid of people who he considers disloyal. And we've been talking about how he's been replacing them, sometimes with people who really have no qualifications for the job. The hit list was compiled in part by a group called Groundswell, a conservative activist group that's headed by Ginni Thomas, who is the wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. Is that considered an ethical conflict of interest?
There are people in the White House who have made that point. Look, Ginni Thomas in her own right is a very prominent and powerful conservative activist, very effective, has built this organization, has huge networks inside the conservative world. But there are people in the White House who have told me that one of the reasons President Trump pays particular attention to her recommendations is partly because she is married to Clarence Thomas. And President Trump has huge regard for Clarence Thomas. He's, you know, had the two of them to the White House for lunch and to meet with them, etc. So certainly people in the White House have raised that issue.
You write that Trump sees himself as invincible ever since he was acquitted in the Senate impeachment trial. And that gambles that he took that were criticized, he thinks those gambles have really worked out for him. So can you talk about that a little bit more, about how he sees himself as invincible now?
It's not just the president. It's also some people in his inner circle, not all of them, but some of them. They are much less likely to listen to the naysayers or voices of caution. And in fact, many of those voices have been fired or have left the administration of their own accord. A good example is early on in the administration, President Trump's Secretary of Defense, James Mattis, his Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, and others were trying to persuade him not to get out of the Iran nuclear deal. They were basically saying to him that, you know, we're in it, we're better off trying to work within the system and making changes than getting out altogether. They also told him, look, it'll cause great chaos in the Middle East if you move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. In the end, so President Trump listened to them for a little bit, delayed those decisions. He was inclined to make both of those decisions much earlier. But, you know, when he was sort of getting his feet firmly on the ground as president in the first year, he did listen somewhat to them and delayed some of these decisions. He ultimately made both of those decisions. Oh, and the other one I'll add into that is withdrawing from the Paris Climate Accord. They also said, look, it's not a good idea. You may as well stay in, work within the system, nourish the alliances. It'll, you know, upset the Europeans if you get out. President Trump did all three against their recommendations. He pulled out of Paris, he moved the embassy, he pulled out of the Iran deal. In his view, all of these chicken littles have been proven wrong, and he's been proven right, and the world still stands, and the sun rises every morning, and the worst things that they predicted didn't happen. So the next time people warn him against, for example, killing Qasem Soleimani, the Iranian general, or any number of very bold, unconventional presidential actions, he is far less inclined to listen to the naysayers and the voices of caution. He is much more inclined to follow his own instincts and to also appoint people who are going to bolster his own instincts.
You have a lot of sources within the Trump administration. What's in it for the sources to talk with you?
All sorts of different motivations, and you've got to be wary of all of them. At the start of the Trump administration, there was a lot of very, very brutal warfare between senior officials. You had, you know, Steve Bannon in open warfare with Jared Kushner, and then Reince Priebus was sort of thrown in there. And so you've had a number of different camps and factions within the White House, certainly for the first year, and they were just shooting at each other. Another motivation, and this is by no means unique to the Trump White House, people occasionally who work in the administration are horrified by certain policy actions, and by exposing them and leaking them out, you know, my sense is they're doing that to try and stop them from coming to fruition. And then I think there's another kind of group of people who sometimes I don't even know why. I think they just enjoy, you know, sometimes late night conversations feel like therapy, sort of 11 o'clock at night, and maybe they've had a couple of glasses of scotch and they're depressed and worn out, and you develop these kind of weird relationships with sources that they feel that they can vent to you. And my thing has always been, I'll talk to anyone. I'm just maniacal about making sure that they're protected and that they know that I will never under any circumstance betray their confidence. I'm also, by the way, going to do my due diligence on what they tell me. For a lot of people, my working assumption is false until proven otherwise.
You're a national political reporter at Axios, and Axios has an HBO series. In the first season, you and your colleague at Axios, Jim Vanderhey, interviewed President Trump, and before the interview, you both talk on camera about what it's like to interview Trump. And one of the points that you make is that if you go at Trump hard, he shuts down. And also, if you ask introspective questions, those are a waste of time with him. You have to ask about topics. Tell us how those calculations figure into how you interview him.
Well, I've only interviewed him on camera once, and my observation from watching every single interview I think that he's ever done, basically, is that, I'll give you an example. You know, at the time when we interviewed him, the Mueller report was still very much, you know, the big story, and everyone was wondering what was going to happen. We crafted some very good, tough, well-crafted questions on the Mueller report. total waste of time. They ended up on the cutting room floor. And the reason is, it doesn't matter what you are. You, again, come up with the best question in the world. As soon as you insert the word Mueller into the sentence, the response is going to be fake news, witch hunt, you know, a torrent of, you know, invective about Mueller and the 17 angry Democrats and all the rest of it. And no matter how many different ways that you try to come at it, it doesn't actually get you anywhere. He's a very challenging person to interview, and I don't think I did a particularly good job at all interviewing him, and I don't know that I'd do a much better job now. And I've never really seen a revealing interview with him. I can't think of a single one where I thought, oh, wow, that one really got him in this certain area. The times when he's been tripped up, I say this with all due respect to the questioners, it's not because of some brilliant interviewing skill, it's just because Trump has said what he really thinks. So, you know, the famous one where Lester Holt asked him about the firing of Comey, and Trump just blurted out that, you know, he didn't like that he was doing the Russia investigation. I don't think Lester Holt would have expected that, or was the crafting of the question. It just happened to be that that day Trump happened to say what he really thought and got himself in a little bit of trouble from it.
Jonathan Swan, thank you so much for talking with us, and thank you for your reporting.
Thanks for having me.
Yesterday, well, it seems so cool.
Brian Ferry is best known as the lead singer of the British art rock band Roxy Music. But in the early 1970s, he released two solo albums filled with covers of well-known pop and rock songs by artists ranging from Bob Dylan to Leslie Gore. A new album, titled Live at the Royal Albert Hall, 1974, captures Ferry singing many of these songs in concert, and rock critic Ken Tucker says it's wonderful to hear.
Oh, where have you been, my blue-eyed son? Where have you been, my darling, your wife? Side of 12 misty mountains, walked and I crawled on 6 crooked highways, but nothing front of a dozen dead ocean diving, 1,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard. And it's a hard, and it's a hard, and it's a hard, and it's a hard, and it's a hard race I'm gonna fall.
In 1973, Brian Ferry released his first solo album called These Foolish Things. It led off with an extraordinary version of Bob Dylan's A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, in which Ferry's tremulous baritone turned folk song into art song, at once elegant and crashingly loud. That radical reinterpretation serves as one of the high points of Live at the Royal Albert Hall 1974. A marvelous concert album that captures Ferry in all his contradictory glory.
They asked me how I knew my true love was true. I, of course, replied, something here inside cannot be denied. Oh no. They said someday you'll find all who love are blind. Ooh, ooh. When your heart's on fire, you must realize smoke is in your eyes.
As the leader of the band Roxy Music, Brian Ferry had been making glam rock with pretensions. He liked to come on stage in a tuxedo. He wrote a lot of the band's material, but when he decided to put out a solo record, he resolved to make a different kind of statement by placing hits by Dylan, the Beach Boys, and Smokey Robinson side by side. He told Rolling Stone magazine at the time, "The solo career is pure style, imposing my style on a ready-made content."
I love how your eyes close whenever you kiss me. Oh, when I'm away from you,
The period during which Ferry was covering these songs was a time when pop music was very much in flux. It was, for the most part, dominated by singer-songwriters such as Jackson Browne, The Eagles, Joni Mitchell, Paul Simon. Punk rock, a reaction to both the singer-songwriters and to the mannerism that Ferry embodied, was just being born. In this context, Ferry's crooning was a sharp challenge. One reason it worked, and still sounds so potent now, is because he backed up his posing with a strong band that included Roxy Music members Phil Manzanera on guitar and Chris Thompson on drums, along with a 33-piece orchestra. You can hear the full force of this combination on Ferry's version of The Beach Boys.
Well, it's been building up inside of me for
Most pop musicians would say that the recording studio is where the art is made, where a track can be meticulously tinkered with to achieve the artist's ideal version of a song. Live performances are about putting on a good show, letting them see you sweat. Passion takes precedence over perfection. But when it comes to a performer like Ferry, for whom precision and restraint are so essentially part of his persona, it becomes an additional thrill to hear him in a circumstance in which he's not completely in control. His voice may crack a little. He may get caught up in the spontaneous jolt of a guitar riff. It becomes fascinating to listen to his fruity baritone strain to be heard over the roar of the music. The results are strong, burly versions of songs such as this cover of Leslie Gore's 1963 pop hit, The In Crowd. I remember quite vividly that when Ferry was making the camp gestures that formed these cover versions, there was a widespread sentiment that what he was doing was merely a stunt, that his solo albums were basically novelty records. But I loved those recordings. The tension they contained sometimes seemed overpowering in its effectiveness. I'm happy to hear how spectacularly well the music holds up now.
Ken Tucker reviewed Brian Ferry's new concert album called Live at the Royal Albert Hall, 1974.
Look, I've been a law enforcement professional for over 20 years, so is it even imaginable to you that I'm fine?
You feel fine?
No, I don't feel fine.
That's my guest, Ben Mendelsohn, who stars as a police detective in the HBO limited series The Outsider, which is adapted from a Stephen King novel. Mendelsohn won an Emmy for his role in the Netflix series Bloodline. He's been in independent films and in franchise films like the Batman film The Dark Knight Rises and the Star Wars spin-off Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, in which he played the director of weapons research for the Empire. Mendelsohn is from Australia, where he started acting in TV and movies when he was 14. On The Outsider, he plays a police detective trying to solve the murder of a young boy whose body was found mutilated in the woods. Everything about the killer, including his fingerprints, fits the description of a popular high school teacher and Little League coach. The detective arrests and questions him, but the coach says he was more than 60 miles away at the time of the murder, and he has evidence to prove it. How can one person be in two places at the same time? Nothing about this case is making logical sense. So an eccentric private eye who seems to have some psychic perception is brought in to help. After considerable investigation, she comes up with an explanation involving the supernatural. Mendelsohn's character thinks bringing the supernatural into the case is an absurd waste of time. Here's Mendelsohn as Detective Ralph Anderson with a fellow detective who's more willing to keep an open mind about the psychic's theory. The other detective, played by Yul Vasquez, speaks first.
Well, if she's right about who's next, it's got to be Claude Bolton.
If she's right?
Yeah. No, I'm not saying, I mean...
That it's logical? That it's rational?
You're not letting me finish.
You know what I think we should do in this investigation next? We should go find a really reputable psychic. If that doesn't work, we should go to a toy store and spring for a Ouija board, because those things are surefire crime solvers.
All she's asking for is that we keep an open mind.
You know what? You keep your mind open. I'm just going to look for facts, evidence, you know, dumb cop like that.
Ben Mendelsohn, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on your starring role in this series. I really like you in this role as like a dependable, rational guy who's kind of hard-boiled, but beneath the surface, like you're still grieving for your dead son. You're in a constant state of like grief and guilt. It's a change for you. I think most people are used to seeing you as like the tough guy, the bad guy, the person who's kind of unreliable and a little bit frightening. So how did you get this part? I would imagine you wouldn't be the first person a casting director would think of for this role.
Ralph Anderson is an absolute gift. The show has just blitzed all my expectations and hopes, and it is a delight. But culturally for me, I knew that being a classical, you know, Gary Cooper type, solid American good guy, was a really good thing. That it meant that I had a chance to continue to work in a variety of roles. Because I had some concern that with, you know, baddie after baddie after baddie, that's going to run its course. So this has been a great gift.
So I want to talk about your eyes for a minute, because in your role in The Outsider, your eyes are filled with sadness.
Yeah.
And some skepticism. You keep people at a distance.
Yep.
And when you compare that to your eyes in things like Bloodline, in which you're like the black sheep of the family and no one trusts you and you've been doing some nefarious things on the side, or Animal Kingdom, where you're part of a family of criminals. Your eyes are threatening in those. I mean, your eyes make you look really dangerous in those. And do you think about your eyes?
I don't, but I do think they're a certain window to the soul. Now, Animal Kingdom, I've seen, I remember seeing a little bit of that. And I found that, what I found kind of, that worked in a terrifying sense was, that guy didn't look like he was in the same room as any of the other people there. And of course, when it gets to direct confrontational stuff, you know, then I don't know that you think about it in terms of such a mechanical way. But Australian males communicate a lot to each other non-verbally. We're a far less verbal bunch. And
compared to American men?
Yeah, and there's a big difference. The big difference in Australia and America is the guns, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you can convey a lot of aggression and a lot of status or a lot of avoidance of that. And this stuff becomes very vital in the outer suburbs and stuff when you're growing up, when you're a young man, when you're a teenager and whatnot. And that's really where I learnt to pretend to have the potential for danger.
So you had to communicate being threatening through your looks. And
yeah,
not
and just
a weapon.
The way you walk and uh-huh. just mm-hmm. an avoidance. You just, there's a certain thing that happens when a guy's of a certain age in Australia and a certain sort of class or strata or whatever pass each other on the street.
But you grew up in, I'd say, I'm guessing like upper middle class because your father ran a brain research institute.
Yeah, no, so here's the interesting thing. You would think that, right?
Yeah, I would think that.
but what essentially happened is that, okay, so there was some early breakup, divorce, kind of ugly stuff, et cetera, et cetera. Now, my father then moved us to what he thought was a more idyllic location, which was the deep outer suburbs bordering the country, the bush, as it were. But I think what Dad misread in his thing is that it's actually quite a tough, rough and tough place. Because we had this sort of wander around, do what you will kind of thing, the people that we were mixing with, this is me and my younger brother David, were, you know, kind of petty crims, kind of, you know, thuggishy kind of just, and also regular, just kind of layabout, lower middle class or working class people. See, my family's interesting in that. Well, it's not interesting, but half of it is my father, who's kind of, you know, he's a bit of a genius, and he's a bit remote, and he's a bit leave the kids, you know, to do what they want, and they'll be fine. And then my mother comes from a very, very working class family, and they have much stronger sense of, you know, right and wrong, and, you know, a much stronger moral compass. So there's a weird mix going on there. And so being amongst, you know, like outer suburban working class kids and stuff like that didn't feel foreign, but you had to, you know, you had to show some front. I mean, it's a bit of a jail mentality that leaks through certain parts of Australia because...
part of Australia's roots is as a penal colony for England that would ship some of its prisoners to Australia. And do you feel like that left a permanent mark on Australian culture?
I am absolutely sure it left a permanent mark.
For people who only know you from the outsider and who haven't heard you in Australian movies and TV shows, or who only know you from your other American movies, it's going to be jarring for them to hear you speaking in this Australian accent. You are Australian, but
yeah.
I'm sure some of your American fans think of you as being American. Have you worked with voice coaches to get American speak down?
Tom Jones. I have the very good pleasure to have Tom Jones is his name. And like the great singer, he is a master at it. And I sort of borrowed Tom Jones from Nicole Kidman.
Oh, and did you already know Nicole Kidman from Australia?
Oh, forever. We pretty much all of us, and particularly of that generation, yeah, we all know each other.
Okay, so what are some of the key things you learned about, like, American pronunciations that you've drawn on?
You guys aren't as lazy as we are. It might take me a moment or two to kind of warm up here, but one of the first things you need to learn is that most of your voice is right up front of the mouth, and there's a lot more muscularity there, et cetera, et cetera. Australians, if you can start to hear it, if I can exaggerate, speak at the back, a lot more through the nose, and we're lazy.
Okay.
You guys use your tongue a lot more. You speak, you have a lot of resonance at the back of your mouth, right, mm-hmm. in the back of your throat.
And more enunciation?
Yeah, better enunciation. Your enunciation is clearer. The placement is further back in the mouth, whereas you want to think of Australians as essentially speaking around their nose area and being much lazier. We shorten names. We want to use the most economical possible route to describe something.
So, what kind of exercises did you have to do in order to speak less nasal and more from, as you describe it, the back of the throat?
I think mainly it's just practice. What we would do is start to practice. You grow up hearing American accents from the time you're born because of television and whatnot. But You just practice with whatever you've got, and then you might drill certain sounds. Like there are certain sounds that there's certain R sounds and stuff that are very tough for Australians, and so you might work on a certain sentence that's very tough. But Tom Jones and I would go and find a particular person from the region where we were shooting, like from Place Beyond the Pines. We found a guy, we recorded him, and then we made our guy him. So you just want to steal, basically.
You grew up in different parts of Europe, right? In addition to growing up in Australia, you lived a few years in Germany with your family. So do you think growing up with different languages helped you with your ear when learning different regions and different styles of speaking for your roles?
Yeah, it helped with that. And the other bit that it helped, because I was so young, is it helped with that thing of being a natural outsider and having to notice how to behave in order to be acceptable. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
So it helped me to look at people and learn how to fit in.
So you've played a lot of dark characters. My understanding is you went through some dark times yourself. Including like drinking. You were expelled from school at the age of 13, is that right?
I very fortunately got kicked out of a school here in the States. It's near where you are. It's in Mercersburg, which is near Harrisburg, and it's like a co-ed boarding school.
Why was it a good thing that you were thrown out?
Because it meant that I went back and I lived with my grandmother after refusing to attend another boarding school here. And after I asked Mama if I could go live with her, she said yes. The next day she rang back, she said no. That was one of the worst days of my life at that point. But my grandmama, who's like one of my saints, said, yes, you can come and live with me. And that's when I started acting shortly thereafter. And within a year or two of going to live with her, I was, you know, a working person. And I mean that in the old-fashioned sense. Like, it was a working class, out on my own, making a living. You know, one of the things I loved about working as an actor was that you kind of felt like you had a family there. And, you know, you worked for 6 months with a bunch of people and you get close. And that really was what I want. That was what I was chasing. It wasn't, you know, and I wanted to get better at acting in order to be able to keep working on sets. That was the drive.
Did you not feel like you had much of a family with your family?
Oh, no, well, no, and that was, I didn't, and that in fact was pretty much how it was. I was living with my with my grandmother by that stage. I mean, look, there were family difficulties, you know, my mother is departed, but everyone else is, alive and kicking, and I love them. You know, I love them.
It must have felt so good to be making a living yourself, because it sounds like you felt a little bit expelled from your family, but here you were, like, supporting yourself when you were in your mid-teens.
Yeah, and I did a lot of other jobs too, because, you know, work isn't constant for an actor almost for most of their working life. So I would, you know, quite happily do whatever jobs, you know, labouring. I worked in a slaughterhouse for a little while, this, that, the other, bunch of stuff.
Helpful later for acting to have been in those positions?
Yep. It's helpful to experience humans. I mean, I think one of the advantages that just ends up happening through British and Australian actors is that we do generally, you do get a lot more of them that come from having had working class experience, whether or not you class them as that or not. Whereas I feel like, and it may be a fantasy of mine, but that actors typically will, you know, study here and blah, 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 and they don't necessarily have those same experiences.
Mm-hmm. So another question about your father, since he ran a brain research center, where he's now a professor emeritus, were you interested in science?
Yeah, I was. The sweetest thing that's ever happened to my dad is he's now one of those guys that just won't shut up about his son. And that never looked like that was a likely occurrence. But the first thing I wanted to be was a spy after watching James Bond.
Oh.
Then I wanted to be a cop after watching Dirty Harry. And then I thought maybe I'd go into something, some computer science thing. And then I took drama as an easy subject. But I have a terrible memory, except when it comes to lyrics and, you know, ridiculous facts and music stuff. So I memorized all the lines of all the people, and I would say them at 10 times the speed. The drama teacher was very impressed, made me do it in front of the whole school, and people that didn't previously think much of me, they got a kick out of it. So I started to get, you know, people enjoyed me more. And that was important. You know, that felt really good.
Ben Mendelsohn, has been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much, and congratulations on The Outsider.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ben Mendelsohn stars in the HBO series The Outsider, which is shown Sunday nights. There are 2 episodes left.